So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And to be honest, Dave, I'm having a little difficulty being positive today.
Because it's so beautiful out here in Middle Tennessee?
Yeah. The weather has turned gloomy and cold. The sky is gray, just a steel gray almost. It's been raining, it seems, for days. It's
yes.
Cold. There was ice in the windshield today.
Yes, and therefore the news has alerted us that the end of times is upon us. Because there was a snowflake spotted in
Hickman
County this morning, I think.
Yeah.
It's not confirmed.
But milk and bread.
It's a sighting.
It's amazing to me, though, how seasonal affective disorder.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm, you know, I'm not entirely, you know, this is terrible. I've lost my vocabulary suddenly. That's what happens when the sky turns gray.
Well, it is.
I lose my vocabulary. Yeah. Now, it's not that I can't function, but I'm definitely, it's like I'm under a heavy blanket today.
Yeah. It feels a bit like that.
Yeah. But this is, nonetheless, the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And what we're going to face today, what we're going to talk about today, David, is that we're going to honestly look at the fact that addiction of all types really is rooted in trauma.
Yes.
If not big T trauma, little T trauma.
Yes, absolutely.
For most of us, the trauma is not dramatic. But for a significant number of people, the blows have come hard and heavy.
Yeah.
And we have a guest coming up whose trauma rivals any I've ever heard.
It does. And she is a remarkable person of safety and rescue and hope for many people who otherwise would not have an empathetic witness to their pain.
Yeah. Well, listeners, you are going to want to prepare yourself for an honest conversation, and it might challenge you a little bit.
It's hard to hear sometimes. Hard to hear.
So stick with us, if you dare, on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Well, we are back in the Positive Sobriety Podcast. David, I don't know about you, but there are times when I am tempted to go to regret, deep regret, for the lost years of active addiction, the decades in which I was just, you know, I was just out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm tempted to think in those periods of negativity that that was all a waste.
Right.
And yet, I'm well aware, even as I sit here today, that all of that time and all of my mistakes and all of the things that people did to me, the wounds I inflicted and the wounds I received, mm-hmm. are redeemable.
Right.
And in some way, that pain that I've gone through can be transmuted into something that's actually healing and helping to others. It's what makes me useful today.
Mm-hmm.
Those years of idiocy, right?
Yeah. And blindness.
And that's a common theme in recovery. We have a higher power who actually wastes nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And never have we gone so far in our acting out or in our using that we're beyond usefulness.
Yeah.
We have a guest today whose story illustrates that truth. Can you introduce our guest for us today?
Absolutely. Lori works with in a way, a very specific population and a very diverse, wide population of people. And her own story has brought her to a place now where she is uniquely, and I don't say this lightly, uniquely equipped to speak in, understand, embrace, and be the hands and feet.
Yeah.
Of
a
Jesus
nurturing presence is what I feel when
exactly.
I'm around Lori.
Yeah. Into families, into people that find themselves in situations they may never have dreamed. But her own story uniquely, I think, prepared her for something that she would have probably not ever dreamed could be redeemed in a way that it has. And Lori, don't let me speak for you because I want you to get plenty of time to share with us how you got here so that we can appreciate here. Can you tell us a little bit about where you've been?
Sure. So I believe that I'm here only by the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up out in Ashland City, a small town out of Nashville, and my mother worked in Brentwood, so functioning alcoholic, and my home was filled with drugs, violence, sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I had said a prayer when I was 7 and had asked God to make it stop.
Mm.
And one night she didn't come home and the police were called. I then was taken into state's custody, put in several different foster homes, at one point group homes. In some of the foster homes, I was being abused. In one home, I was locked in a basement for days without food.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in the foster care system from 7 to 13, and for my 13th birthday, my mother, where she worked in Brentwood, had paid for her to go to treatment, and the state awarded her custody. And she had picked me up. It was actually my 13th birthday, and actually took me straight to the bar.
Wow.
She was selling me for drugs and alcohol, and at that point, I just wanted to die, and so I think I made 3 different attempts to commit suicide, and when I couldn't die, that's when I found alcohol.
Mm.
And so I started drinking at 13 and whenever I could, and doing drugs. And then at 16, my mother basically said that I was making her look bad and that I had to get out. I had nowhere to go, so I called a friend on the cheerleading squad, and she had a friend. And I had no idea what a pimp was, but they basically said, "We're going to Tampa. We'll give you a roof over your head." I got a fake ID that said I was 27 and Puerto Rican, and put me to work in the trafficking world.
Wow.
And so I would drink and drug as much as I could, and had no idea what a pimp was.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew I was grateful to have a roof over my head. My drug addiction was through the roof. So a couple of different pimps had taken me, and I escaped at 18 and ended up back here in Nashville, at which time I was then taken by a guy in the mafia and stamped and branded that he owned me, and so he was very violent. And there have been periods and attempts in my story at sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be moments when he would beat me so bad, you know, the police were called because they could hear me screaming and come in, and I would attempt to go to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But he would pay people to find me. He'd pay $15,000 to find me.
Wow.
Threatened to kill my family,
mm-hmm.
which I was afraid that he was really going to kill him, so I would always go back.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been in and out of treatment 8 times at this point. I think I was baptized 3 different times. Just, you know, "Pastor, can we try it again?" It didn't take.
Yeah.
You know, running to Jesus and not understanding why my drug addiction, I just could not stop.
Yeah.
And so at 22, he had beaten me with a set of golf clubs, and I had escaped him this time, and there was a hired killer that I knew he wouldn't mess with and had went to see him. And, you know, at this point, I was drinking and drugging, you know, nonstop. Mm-hmm. When I would sleep, I'd stay up for days and days and days, and had a car wreck. So I had escaped this guy and was out in the streets, taken by another pimp, and had had a car wreck, hydroplaned, was crushed in the vehicle. And when I woke up on my 22nd birthday in Vanderbilt Hospital, my first thought was, God, why didn't you let me die? Mm. What? You know, mm-hmm. crushed in the vehicle. My ankle was shattered. So I was hooked up to a morphine pump in the hospital, smoking crack. Mm. The guy in the mafia actually called the hospital and said, you know, you're damaged goods. If you ever say anything, I'll kill you. So proceeded to check myself out of the hospital and started walking the streets. Murfreesboro Road, Dickerson Road, and, you know, my drug addiction was through the roof, and I couldn't die. Had gotten pregnant with my son out of a rape. Mm-hmm. Had been in and out of jail, I guess, 15 times, and this is back before human trafficking was really acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And so, sure. You know, they've come light years with that. But my charges were soliciting, paraphernalia, failure to appear. And I knew that I had this baby, and all the women and the people on the streets, they had crack babies and they were loosing them. And so I just said another prayer, you know, God, if you come back, I don't want to be here. Please help me. And every mm-hmm. time I prayed, the police showed up. It was just this bizarre thing of like, I don't know if I want to pray anymore because he sends the police. But anyway, and my sister at this time was like 22 years sober, working at Cumberland Heights. And so she would come and pick me up out of a field after I'd been raped or, you know, had put me in all these treatment centers. Mm-hmm. And this last time, I didn't know, she had gone around to several churches and asked them to pray for me that I wouldn't die in the streets. And she asked, because I knew I was pregnant and I had to stop and I didn't know, Vanderbilt Hospital was going to amputate my leg because of the infection and the drugs. And so she asked me if I'd go to treatment one more time. And there was a place in Columbia, Tennessee called the Place of Hope where they mm-hmm. wouldn't take your insurance. You had to be prayed in there, which I knew I wasn't going to get in. Like, there's no way God's going to answer that for me. And so she had taken me for the interview, and 2 weeks later, they heard from God apparently. And asked me to come. And I had lost custody of my son, and I'll never forget the way that that felt. And I, in a lot of ways, had become my mother. Mm. Aside from trafficking, you know, my mm-hmm. child, mm-hmm. I had really become the very thing that I hated.
Yeah.
And couldn't quite figure out that internal struggle. And so, I went to the treatment center, and it was faith-based 12-step recovery, mm-hmm. and completed that and got out, and then started going to AA, mm-hmm. 12-step recovery. But at this point, I didn't trust women at all. Mm-hmm. Was not really sure about a sponsor. Didn't really quite under, I mean, considering my yeah. background, I'm like, okay, what's this about?
What's that stand for?
Yeah, that yeah. might be good for you, but I don't trust people.
Yeah.
So I had a slip, and on that slip had gotten pregnant again from a gentleman that was in the drug world and a part of human trafficking. And you know, my entire pregnancy with my son, off and on, I used cocaine. With my daughter, I was on methadone. Mm. So my son was actually born addicted to cocaine, and my daughter was born addicted to heroin and methadone. Mm. And then it was just that place of, I really want to die. So in my slip, I couldn't quite figure it out. I'd lost my daughter. I'd lost my son, and it was really angry. And you know, the term don't drink, go to meetings. I was doing that. And still, I was almost getting worse, not better.
Yeah.
So I couldn't quite figure that out. So I think at that point it was just an internal surrender without my permission. Mm. And at that jumping off place of I can't live with it for sure because a lot of it had just stopped working. Mm-hmm. And now I don't know what to do without it. Can't live without it. What do you do now? Mm-hmm. So went back in to AA and decided to try the sponsorship thing and made a commitment to, okay, I'm going to try this just to prove you wrong. So that was in 2006. Uh-huh. And my life began to change little by little. The first thing I knew was I had no idea how to be a parent. Mm-hmm. So now I'm sober.
Yeah.
But there's still all of this stuff beneath the surface. What do you do now?
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. on fire, but really didn't have a clue. Mm-hmm. So I had to have a lot of help. And so got custody of my son. started a business because really for employment, prostitution does not look good on a resume. Mm-hmm. So I was like, God, what do I do? Like, uh-huh. how am I going to provide? And so I had worked in some recovery places that uh-huh. just knew that I needed a lot of help. And then I started a business here in Brentwood and practiced things like integrity and not stealing people's stuff and helping them look for it. That was a big deal. You know, but the sense of integrity behind that was just yeah. life-giving, and being trusted was new. Learning to be honest with myself and others. I'm still a work in progress, but mm-hmm. I just had no idea what that looked like. And so I went back to school for a while at the University of Phoenix. I started doing therapy at the Rape and Sexual Assault Center once a week. I did that for 5 years. Helped the RACEX Center raise money for other survivors. And so we would do things like Ethan would come home from school and we would talk about things and little girls would write him letters. And to me, there was something in my gut that went, why as a 7-year-old want to have a baby with my son? Mm-hmm. Because we communicated, the school did some investigation and she was being abused. So then he was put in prison and the little girl was helped.
Wow.
So my, even the healing in my sobriety piecemeal has been mm-hmm. useful. So, working two jobs, going to school full time, and trying to raise a son was a lot of work. So, I had to take some breaks. And I started doing some Al-Anon recovery stuff. And really was kind of at the point. So, let me tell you about this. So, I'm a below the knee amputee. I'd lost my leg in drug addiction, escaping some people. And I'd learned to walk all over again, but so I have a cleaning business and my leg would get these sores. Mm. And I would get up and go to work and clean 8,000 square feet homes and grateful to do it and mm-hmm. you know, anything. Mm-hmm. And I would get these sores. And so I'd sit in my quiet time in the morning going, God, I'm not real sure where you're at, but my leg hurts. And when it gets a sore, I have to keep it off for 3 days. I have to provide food for my child. Mm-hmm. The bills have to be paid. Mm-hmm. Where are you? Mm-hmm. So, the following day, a friend had reached out to me and she said, she had no idea what God and I had been talking about, but she said, I've got somebody I'd like you to meet. At which point was a gentleman who owned the surgical clinic in Nashville and basically had me change insurance and said, you know, it had been 14 years since I had ran. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you a running blade and teach you to run. And, you know, if you'll run races, all your stuff will be free. And in that, you will help raise money for children that can't afford, that want to play sports.
Wow.
That cannot afford the limbs. Mm-hmm. Or 10 Care gives them a limb that's really made for a 60-year-old diabetic.
Mm. Yeah.
So then I just knew that God heard me and mm-hmm. that I mattered to God. So I, in the meantime, I could get up and move and bend and do all these things. So I attempted to go back to school. So back in school, able to do a lot more with my time. No more sores. I can go and go and go. And, you know, it's just a game changer for me. So I had lost custody of my daughter, and her aunts had come to me one day and said, you know, we think that your daughter's being abused. And I'm like, well, those are pretty strong allegations. What makes you say that? Mm-hmm. Well, the long and short of it, he had a history of doing those things, even to family members. And I had prayed about it. And because at this time I had just had visitation, but it's in my heart, I didn't want to rip her from what she knew. And I thought, okay, God, when she gets old enough and she tells me, I'm going to get her. And she was going to school and cutting and doing these things. And bizarre enough, I was actually in school working on my bachelor's in science for drug addiction and human services. So I would write a paper and go for a visit, and all the signs were there. So began the process of getting custody of my daughter, and was awarded that. It was a long process. And when I brought her home, she was grunting and growling and barking and hiding under furniture. She was clawing herself and cutting and nonverbal. So I dropped out of school. Began all of my therapy stuff with my daughter, and it's been quite a road. So the other thing that I began to do was family of origin work and trauma recovery, because I really needed to know the core of it to be able to reach her, to help her up off the floor.
Yeah.
So that's been a journey, and I've had her a little over 2 years now. Okay. She was actually nominated by the principal of the school 2 months ago to lead coping skills and etiquette at the middle school and to lead a Bible study.
Really?
Wow.
Man.
So, wow. Yeah, it's crazy what God will do if I'll just get out of the way and trust Him in the middle of adversity.
That's amazing. All of that is amazing. I'm kind of speechless right now, which doesn't happen very, very often. So, Lori, when did you begin to realize that in your sobriety, in your story, did these opportunities just begin to come to you, that you know, someone heard about you, heard you might be able to help this, heard you might know some way to intervene in this way? How did you end up in this chapter in your life now, where you wake up and find yourself? And I don't know, in my sobriety, there are days where I wake up and go, wow, who was that that lived that first 45 years? You know, who did that compared to where my world is today? How were people finding you, and that it led you into this place now that you're able to full time kind of be in the rescue and provide refuge and shelter people business?
Well, I am of the belief, and I've always said this, that God does all of it without my permission.
Yeah, I love that line that you use.
Well, it's just He does without my permission. So, you know, beginning the recovery process and the drugs and alcohol being removed was really a gift, but it was just the tip of the iceberg for me to kind of surrender. And in my life, there are many different levels of surrender. So when it really, the catalyst for all of that began was when I started doing therapy. And it dawned on me that recovery is multifaceted, that I needed more than just sobriety, that there was a level of emotional recovery that I didn't know. And that if I was really going to show up and be present and in life, that I needed to have something more than just don't drink.
Yeah.
So I was at work one day. Once again, God without my permission, had gotten very close to a client. I believe you know them. And we were just having a conversation while I was at work. And you know, had mentioned just a little bit. I think I had built trust enough, had been known her for 8 years. Mm-hmm. Was finally like, okay, maybe if I tell her. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of shame work that needed to be done, a lot of abandonment. Like,
I can only imagine.
There's still just, we could talk recovery at a surface level, but nobody mm-hmm. was really getting in.
Yeah.
And so when that conversation happened, she just, her mouth hit the floor and said, oh my God, this is ministry. And I'm like, well, what is that? What does that word mean? Uh-huh. What do you mean ministry? I'm not real sure about that. And I knew, I was scared that if I went into church, the building was going to cave in on me. So I, you know, associate ministry with church and yeah. what? Oh my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, so she and some of her friends had started a nonprofit for sober living homes in Williamson County, and I was asked to be on the board of that. At which point, you know, I started telling my story. And each time I told it, there was this healing mm-hmm. that happened and this trust that was built. And, you know.
Within yourself.
But also when I would sit and tell it, everybody in the room would cry.
Well, yeah, because mm-hmm. you're the safest person in the room because.
It's bizarre.
If I'm going to tell anybody anything, it'll be you. You know what I mean?
I guess,
because
yeah.
you're the gift of vulnerability to these people. But anyway, I'm interrupting you. Sorry.
Sure. No, it's good. But little by little, you know, and then learning the groups that I would speak to. So there would be elderly people, and I was terrified to hurt them with it. So, mm-hmm. you know, really needing to do some other work so that the discernment piece was in there. But also being filled up at the same time. So I started to see how all of the shameful things, all of the things inside were actually, when they were exposed, were useful to God. Uh-huh. So I did that for 2 years and, you know, meanwhile, in the background, getting custody of my daughter, walking through some of this, and I needed to step away for a while and do a little bit more work around some things and to be present for her. So then I was asked to be on a leadership team for 50 churches for human trafficking. And let me tell you this, had I known that that's what it was, I would have said no way. Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't understand God, and I had a lot to work through there. Mm-hmm. I was actually sexually abused by a man that looked like the picture of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
So I could not. I had mm-hmm. to do some deep work. So I did a bunch of trauma recovery and unpacking that, and more as not Christ from the perspective of a father, but more of a son. So I did a lot of work and counseling in that. And so 6 months later, I'm leading this thing, and I don't even know what it is, and there's 50 churches represented, and they weren't arguing, which was mind-blowing to me. Like, they all like the same guy. They're all doing, like, this is profile. And I had always thought that, like, all these different religions, but don't you all love the same person? I mean, not person, but God. And
yeah.
So it's just been one of those things inwardly that I had secretly kind of go, now, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to pick? Mm-hmm. If I do go, you know, I don't know. So anyway, it was just this beautiful thing I ended up in. I couldn't figure out why these people love me just because I had a pimp. That was me. And they were like, oh, no, that's biblical. That's actually scripture. So I've just begun this healing work with Papa, is who I refer to my higher power as. And so the different things that we do... or that, you know, from my story, so the foster care system I have gone when someone adopts or fosters a foster child, if there are some behavioral things going on, they'll ask if I'll just come and sit, and it becomes this beautiful healing thing once again for me, but also drops of hope into these children. I watch their faces, and we identify, and there's just this beautiful tapestry of it's all useful. Mm-hmm. They're not alone, and I'm not alone, and God is in the middle. Mm-hmm. That sacred space between the two of us is actually holy ground. Mm-hmm. If I can get out of the way and invite Papa in that space. And so So the other thing that we do is the human trafficking piece. And so when there are survivors in Nashville, Tennessee, and let's say that the current openings in the other programs, they're so full, there's waiting lists
right.
for 6 months. Well, I'm right. on the ground. I'm in the streets doing ministry. They will call me mm-hmm. or our team and say, okay, we've got a survivor. Can you walk with her? And so, you know, the first thing is, how do we get her off alcohol and drugs? Mm-hmm. So we lay the groundwork for that. And then how do we walk with you from a whole... It's mind-blowing when you go from living that lifestyle. It's almost a culture shock to move into sobriety and just have a normal conversation.
Mm. Wow, yeah.
So we do that. I love the homeless people. So the other thing that I do is when I was strung out and in the streets and being trafficked, I would spend a lot of holidays in crack motels. And so... for a long time, it's just been twice a year that I'll go on the holidays and make meals and take clothes and knock on those doors, because when I do that, I can actually see the grace of God on my life. But now we're doing that once a week mm-hmm. and they're actually going to plant churches. So, I don't know. I don't know if I answered that
The way that you wanted, but... more than better, yeah.
Everything in my life is useful, and it just really blows my mind.
Yeah. But what I hear from you is, like, I always say where gratitude and desperation intersect is where worship happens. And I hear gratitude from you. I mean, why else would you go back to a crack hotel? You know what I mean? Unless you were so grateful for what God has done in you, with you, that you wanted to be some part, a vehicle to offer that to someone else.
Well, I will tell you that's beautiful, but for me, the gratitude shows up when I'm there. I'm not grateful in the beginning. What I am, honestly,
I love that.
Is consumed with myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so distracted.
Yeah.
That it forces me to my knees to go, Papa,
yeah,
help me.
Yeah.
And then the opportunity arises.
Mm-hmm. What an honest answer.
And mm-hmm. in that moment,
yeah,
the gratitude shows up, but it isn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from Papa.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
I want to ask you a question. We had a little prayer time before we switched the recorders on. And in your prayer, Lori, if I heard you correctly, you asked Papa to help you grieve. And that's been a bit of a theme here in the last couple episodes of the Positive Sobriety Podcast, this thing about good grief,
mm-hmm.
that grief being an essential part of positive sobriety. That can be something that we're so terrified of, and we think that positive sobriety has to be all unicorns and rainbows and applause and happiness, but there is something healing and helpful about grief. Can you tell us what's behind that prayer and that desire that you would even want to grieve well?
Beautiful question. So if we go back from the beginning of my story, there was nothing but sadness and darkness and torture and abuse, actually my entire life,
mm-hmm.
until recovery. And I had, for years, would cry and use that as a manipulative tool or a way to work the system.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just sort of stuck. And now I do a lot of work that I refer to as clean grief.
Mm-hmm.
Where the temperature of the tears are cool on my cheek.
Mm.
And it's more of a cleansing. So, and it ties into the vulnerability piece. Am I safe enough to just be real?
Mm.
And so it's deeper layers of what it was I was medicating with the alcohol and drugs.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where I went, no matter who I was with, I was always running from me.
Mm-hmm.
And in my recovery, God has set me down without my permission, what do you do when you can't drink and you can't drug? Uh-huh. And, you know, you walk around in a recovery world where everyone seems so happy, but inwardly you're going, I'm not. Uh-huh. I'm angry. I don't understand. And there's these trauma PTSD responses. And, you know, uh-huh. I can do it for a little while. I can put the face on. Uh-huh. But inwardly there is this, you know, some people in sobriety for years will end up depressed or end up committing suicide or... Yeah, I don't want that. I also mm-hmm. want to learn how to have healthy relationships and show up and be the mother that God would intend. Or how can I be on a leadership team in a room with these fabulous, safe, gentle men, but be kind and loving and present in that and not be activated? Mm-hmm. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
Yeah.
And so it's bizarre, but my therapist will say, you're the only person I know that gets excited to run towards your grief. But I'm tired of running.
Wow.
You know, and, but it's just, the grief work is different. The temperature of the tears are different. It is more release than self-pity or despair. It is a sadness, but I know that Papa's moving in it. And so when I show up for something that's useful, those tears are cleansing versus just sadness.
Right. Yeah.
Did I answer that correctly?
Beautifully. Okay. Yeah. Beautifully.
So, Lori, what would you like the community to know, understand how in this unique place that you live and work and operate, what is helpful? What is not? What do people need to be aware of? Most of us have the life you've described only happens on television, you know? It doesn't.
We drive through those parts of town oblivious.
Yeah. And you had experiences here in the wealthiest county in Tennessee that we didn't have to go to under a bridge in Nashville to experience something. This is in the wealthiest county in Tennessee. And I think the 8th or 10th or 12th wealthiest county in the whole country, you know. So what do people in affluence need to know about their community?
Well, I will tell you, if I may, that I have a profound respect for Williamson County. There was an incident where my daughter's father had threatened to kill us. We were leaving church and I just love coffee, and he was sending death threats, and Williamson County was dispatched, which, unbeknownst to me, has the funds to train and educate for human trafficking. They've done several stings here and had him arrested for a Class E felony. There was victim witness advocates in the court in Franklin, and so... There are people that little by little are becoming aware of the, just what basically is hiding in plain sight, you know? I think one of the things that is key in the recovery world is the first word of the first step, which is we, which is what terrifies most people. Now, in the beginning, it is surface level. It is, okay, got to do some things. Some things have to change. But there is so much more freedom available. And so I think, and I know for myself, that the we is crucial. It is life-giving to form trust with people that know how to hold that. You know, we cannot recover alone. And so I think safety, finding support. Really, the other thing I would challenge people to do is to, you know, if you've hit a certain point in your recovery, maybe pray about going to the next level. There's always more, and there's always a surrender. And I really believe inwardly that until I die, you know, that's when the work is finished. That's when it's finished. Because there's so much, like a limitless load of treasure. It's hard work, but it's very possible.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, I cannot thank you enough for sharing your time and your story with us. This is a beautiful demonstration of repentance and service. You've done service work this morning. And the beautiful thing is that days, weeks, months, years from now, this work will continue.
Mm-hmm.
Because our conversation will be there on the internet for people to access. And Papa will make sure that people who need to hear what you said today will have a chance to hear it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We'll be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Wow, Nate. We just heard a treasure of things.
And I've got to tell you, when Laurie walked in, I hadn't met Laurie before. When Laurie walked into the studio, we had a friendly conversation. We talked for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Then she mentioned that she was a Blade Runner. I thought she was speaking metaphorically.
Right.
I laughed.
Yeah.
And then looked down and noticed that, she's got
a prosthetic blade.
Yeah. She is that at ease with that part of her story and that disability that you wouldn't even know unless she mentioned it.
Right.
Right. And I see also in her, I feel in her kind of this, she has come to terms, she's at peace with all of her story.
Mm-hmm.
She's not awkward with it.
Mm-hmm. She's very careful about how she stewards her story.
Yeah.
And you know, I noticed as we talked and the way she so carefully chooses how she says what she says, but also I realized the potential for trigger that someone like Laurie has every time they go out to speak or goes into a situation that regards the past and things that have happened. Just the potential that that she risks in order to communicate what she has to say is pretty tremendous.
It brings to mind one of those, you know, memorable phrases from actually the promises of AA, that we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door
close
on
the door on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, very helpful and memorable conversation. I especially was helped by her comments on grief. I'm going to want to re-listen to those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a beautiful explanation.
Well, we have more wonderful guests coming up in upcoming episodes. We've got a full recording schedule ahead of us.
We do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Meanwhile, listeners, we would love to hear from you. If you have a comment, a question, if you have a suggested topic or a suggested guest, if you want something clarified, if you want to push back, we'd love to hear from you. And you can reach us by email. Just shoot us an email at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. And if you're a part of a recovery group that you think would benefit from this podcast and want to share this with them, please know that this is for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, until next time, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we're your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.